Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
I think Zelensky is maybe the greatest salesman of any politician that's ever lived. Every time he comes to our country, he walks away with $60 billion.
Well, he ain't wrong. Donald Trump says what many Americans think, and the media fails to talk about. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do it. All right, let's get started. Look, say what you want about Donald Trump, and certainly there's plenty that can be said. One thing you can also say about him, for certain, is that he tends to have his finger on the pulse of what deep down Americans think. And he will say what most politicians won't say, even when they know it's true. And so it is with Mr. Trump's comment once again this weekend about unelected Ukrainian strongman. Here, let me play this for you again. Here's Mr. Trump talking about Mr. Zelensky.
I think Zelensky is maybe the greatest salesman of any politician that's ever lived. Every time he comes to our country, he walks away with $60 billion.
By the way, he didn't finish with just that. So Mr. Trump goes on to say, so now here's the beauty. These are his words. I'm doing Trump for you. Now here's the beauty, he says. He just left 4 days ago, he's talking about Zelensky, with $60 billion. He gets home and he announces that he needs another $60 billion. It's like it never ends. It never ends, stop quote, says Mr. Trump. So he kept talking about this thing for quite a long time and has gotten a lot of attention. Now, Mr. Trump's comments, interestingly enough, come as the so-called Ukraine-Russia peace summit in Switzerland turned out to be a bit of a bust. Half the countries invited did not show up, and many that did show up, like India and Mexico and Saudi Arabia and South Africa and Thailand and the United Arab Emirates, all voted against the final resolution. So most didn't go, and those that did go couldn't agree with the rest. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump said over the weekend that he would have the Russia and Ukraine matters settled before he even moves into the White House. Now, it's not like Mr. Trump to brag, but no matter what you think of him, he may be onto something here, like he once was with the wall, that's going to spark a chord with many Americans, I think. Manella, what do you think?
Well, like you said, Rick, he ain't wrong. While I mostly agree that Zelensky is perhaps the greatest snake oil salesman that ever lived, I have very little confidence that this big money laundering scheme was the brainchild of some B-list actor, which Zelensky is. He's an actor, let's not forget. He spent his whole adult life up until 2019 as a comedic TV actor. To say that a guy who made his money being a court jester to oligarchs dreamed up this intricate plan to procure billions of dollars from the West is absurd to me. I mean, rather, I see this guy as an actor, once again, playing the role of, you know, fearless president or whatever of a war-torn country. In fact, he's not even the president of Ukraine anymore, as you alluded to. His term expired in May, but there's been no election set up. He is just a day player in this theater of war, Rick. When the real producers of this war, the U.S., when they're done with him, he's going to suffer the same fate as all these other world leaders who have been cast in this particular role before him, like Saddam Hussein, Hosni Mubarak, Osama bin Laden, and even to some degree, Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah, and I think the proof may be in the pudding, or the lack of negotiation pudding, in that the Russian delegation, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, has on several occasions in the past, not so much now, been willing to sit down with him and the Ukrainian side and say, let's come up with a deal. Let's see how we split this baby up. Let's see what we can do. And every time, it seems like Zelensky kind of wanted to, but then somebody tapped him on the shoulder and said, no, 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 no. You're not negotiating anything, not without our permission. And I think that's the point you're making. And I think you're right. I mean, I think it's been clear up to now that that's been the case.
He's acting the part, Rick. I really believe that. Yeah. I don't think he's making the decisions here. The director is giving the call, and he's just acting it out.
Something really bizarre happened yesterday, by the way, that's kind of embarrassing for the Biden administration, which prides itself, pardon the pun here, on diversity. So here's what happened. We've got some pictures to show you. Members of the LGBT community tried to have a march to commemorate Pride Month there in Kyiv. But you know how long it lasted before it had to be shut down? According to some reports, less than 5 minutes. Why? Because Ukrainian neo-Nazis showed up. Oh, wait. Nobody's supposed to know that the country that we're giving hundreds of billions of dollars to is brimming with neo-Nazis. So whatever you do, don't let anybody know that you heard that, because we're not supposed to know that here. Anyway, the neo-Nazis showed up. Police became concerned that, so concerned, they just shut the whole thing down for, quote, security reasons, according to local media reports there in Kyiv, by the way. So much for supporting a country that supports your values, Mr. President. I don't know, Manila. That whole thing sounds weird.
Look, it's easy to blame those darn neo-Nazis, but it's not only them, Rick. I mean, like it or not, most civilians of the world are not on board with this American-style support of alternative lifestyles. But their governments have to play ball with America if they wish to continue to receive American monetary aid. Take, for example, Hungary. It's both an EU member and a NATO member. The Prime Minister Viktor Orban has taken a hardline approach to keeping the Hungarian culture less Occidental, more traditional. He was furious when last year, I believe it was, Samantha Power, President Biden's appointed head of USAID, made this unannounced trip to Budapest, meeting with NED-funded activist groups and other groups to outline American policy for receiving future grants, to include having gay pride parades in their country. So USAID goes around to all these different countries saying, if you want to keep getting those sweet American greenbacks, you have to host pride parades under the guise of human rights.
Which is good. I mean, they should be able to host pride parade, and anybody who believes in anything in this world should have a right to march down their street and say, this is what I believe in. That's fine. But the fact that this country has neo-Nazis who showed up to take on the gay pride marchers is just so uniquely Biden-esque. At a time when we're giving this country money because we think they're a democracy just like us, they can't even have a gay pride parade that lasts more than 5 minutes without neo-Nazis breaking it up. That picture in and of itself is worth at least 1,000 words. By the way, we talk a lot here, you and I, Manila, about corporate media. Well, guess what? Leave it to Jon Stewart, of all people, to explain it, perhaps better. Why Jon Stewart? Let me tell you what's happening here. So he recently quit Apple Media. They'd hired him to do some kind of podcast he was doing. He did it for like a year and a half or so. But he quit when he realized that they wanted to control what he said. And here's how he describes basically not just his situation with Apple, but with all the media in the U.S. Here it is.
When you work for a corporate entity, that's part of the deal. Like even at Comedy Central, like the deal is I get to do what I want until they think it's going to hurt their beer sales or whatever it is that they want to sell. And that's the deal we all make. Nobody is owed a platform. And when you're in somebody's house and they want you to take your shoes off, you take your shoes off or you go to somebody else's house.
Yeah. In his case, he's talking about beer sales. Here's another case, though, where he's talking about corporate military money and their sales. Here's Cenk Uygur, who I also know, just like I know Jon Stewart and I, we have a history together. Cenk Uygur founded something called TYT. He reacts to Stewart's comment by sharing what happened to him at the start of the Iraq War when he worked for MSNBC that was owned at the time by General Electric. Hear his story.
So GE was a giant defense contractor, and when the Iraq War started, they made billions on top of billions of dollars, not just from military contracts, but also power contracts they got with the new Iraqi government, etc. So before the Iraq War started, they fired everyone who was against the Iraq War that was on their air. So they fired Phil Donahue, Jesse Ventura, they moved Ashley Banfield's office into a closet. So because GE made so much more money from those defense contracts than they did from the good ratings that Phil Donahue got.
You know why I wanted you to hear these guys? You know why I want you to hear guys like this who are two smart guys, by the way. You may agree or disagree with their political opinions, left, right, whatever, but nonetheless, because often we hear, I myself am guilty of this, I always throw out the term corporate media or mainstream media, figuring everybody knows what we mean, what we're talking about. Too often, a lot of people don't understand when we use that term what we're actually talking about. It's a term we see and we know because we live this every day in this business. But a lot of you sitting there watching me right now, you don't know that. You don't know that a lot of the people you watch on television are actually sharing an opinion with you. They have to keep their job, because the corporation that either influences their company or owns their company makes them do it, interestingly enough. Did I explain that right, Manila?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair and succinct. I mean, we get it. You and I both have been there. We've worked for what is commonly referred to as mainstream media, but perhaps I think it is more accurate to say it's corporate media. And that's just the truth coming from Jon Stewart. That's what the industry is. And not only do on-air talent know at this point, Rick, and understand this, but now the cat is out of the bag and even the audience understands it. That's why we are seeing this huge growth in people seeking news from independent sources, from journalists who are crowdfunded or by other means. I mean, respected names like Matt Taibbi or Chris Hedges, media giants like even Tucker Carlson have dumped corporate media and ventured out on their own, and the audience is following. Corporate media, I say, is in its death spiral and gasping its last breaths, as far as I can tell.
And let me give you some advice, by the way, those of you who are listening to this conversation between us right now. Whenever you hear corporate media tell you that somebody who isn't them is, quote, propaganda, remember, propaganda is in the eye of the beholder. So
eye of the deep pockets, Rick.
More often than not, the guy saying, like, we're, Manila and I are propaganda, those are the propagandists, more often than not. All right. Thanks, kiddo. See you in a bit. When we come back,
you got it.
Co-wrote one of the greatest nonconformist books of all time, which was turned into one of the greatest documentaries of all time. Professor Peter Kuznick, director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. There he is, surrounded by all the books he's read or written. When we come back, you stay right there.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
У каждого была какая-то своя точка переломная, точка невозврата, так можно сказать.
Здесь все совсем другое. Здесь все быстро и просто.
От России никто не отворачивался. Мы с ней и росли, мы с ней и жили.
Русским был, есть и буду.
Здесь не просто мужчины, здесь лучшие люди, не лучше нас.
Уход! Уход!
Все будет хорошо. Прорвемся.
Вариантов-то нет. Надо до конца добивать все это мероприятие. Иначе будет только хуже.
Реально бояться можно. Прям можно бояться. Но трусить нельзя. Лучше мы будем здесь воевать, чем они придут туда, к нам домой.
Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. So the book and the documentary that I just told you about a little while ago, which I am a big fan of, obviously, is called The Untold History of the United States. Now, if you haven't read it, if you haven't watched it, you should. I mean, you really should. It's that good. It will change how you see the world. And I would argue, if you read this book or watch this documentary, which last I checked, I think it was on Amazon, you'll be smarter. You just will. You'll be smarter. Joining me now is the co-writer of that book, or the co-author, I guess. You know, when you write a book, you become an author. You go beyond the writer level, I guess. Professor Peter Kuznick is good enough to join us. Professor, how are you, sir?
I'm pretty good, Rick. Thanks. The world is not doing so well right now, but personally, I'm okay.
What do you think of Donald Trump coming out and saying what he said? You know, I don't know if you agree with me, but I said at the beginning of this newscast, I said he's saying not only what he thinks is the pulse of the American public thinking, but also what most politicians and members of the media are afraid to say, even though they know it's the truth. To that, you say what?
I say, in between the gibberish, the lies, gobbledygook, the fascist rhetoric, every once in a while, he hits on some truth. But that doesn't make him any less dangerous.
Yeah. But in this particular case, I mean, why does it take Donald Trump to say something that is so obvious that it literally does seem like every time this guy knocks on the door at the White House, they say, here's $60 billion. Here's $60 billion. Here's $60 billion. And then he says, "Wah, not enough money. Here's another $60 billion. That's crazy.
It's crazy, and the Ukrainian people are the biggest victims of this. That's the sad truth about this, that if we look at it 2 months from now, a year from now, 2 years from now, it's Ukraine that's going to suffer more than any other country. So it's not really largesse. This is really money that we're giving them to fight and die for a cause that a handful of leaders are supporting in the West.
I want to stop you. I want to stop you because there's a lot of people listening to the sound of your voice right now, and they're wondering, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense what the professor just said. How can you continually give somebody, a country, $60 billion, which is more than most countries in the world have, period, and then you say that we're being unfair to them and we're hurting them? How can you be unfair to somebody if you're giving them $60 billion, professor?
We're giving them $60 billion to fight against Russia because the United States has had this hostility to Russia that goes back to the Brest-Litovsk Treaty that pulled Russia out of World War I. It goes back to the Russian Revolution back in 1917. And then with the end of the Cold War, you would think that U.S. enmity, hostility toward Russia would end, but that never happened.
No.
I mean, we look about NATO expansion. What George Kennan, the architect of the Cold War, said was that this makes no sense to build up this military bloc against a country that's our friend. And so we did. We expanded NATO. We made a deal in 1990, as you know, with Gorbachev, in which we said, if you allow the unification of Germany, that NATO will not expand 1 inch to the east. But Gorbachev never got that in writing. And they began planning that same year in 1990 for NATO expansion. It doesn't finally occur until 1998, when the Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Poland are admitted. But now it's expanded up to Russia's doorstep. Russia was not our enemy during that time. In fact, we had American advisors effectively telling Yeltsin what to do. And it was the advice that they were giving, the shock therapy that destroyed the Russian economy in the 1990s. Putin gets into power and he times it perfectly because energy prices are going up. And the beginning of Putin's reign there was a period of relative prosperity when they were bouncing back from the horrors of the 1990s. You know, the average life expectancy dropped from 66 years at the end of the Soviet period down to 57 years. The economy shrank to the size of the Netherlands. Russia was a basket case. Putin oversaw the period of Russian growth and rebound. But the United States did not like that. And we pulled out of the ABM treaty in 2002, and that's when Russia began its nuclear modernization.
Why didn't the United States like that? I hear this all the time, and I know what happened since, obviously. Reading books by you and others, I've come to realize what happened in 2014, which is essentially a fomented coup by us. But you're going even further back. Help me and others understand what triggered for the United States the need to have Russia as an enemy rather than a friend. Why?
The neocons, for the most part. In 1990, one of the leading neocon theorists, Charles Krauthammer, said that now with the collapse of the Soviet Union, this is America's unipolar moment. We are the world's hegemonic power. Hmm. Nobody can challenge us anywhere, and nobody should be allowed to emerge who can challenge us even in any specific region. In 1990, he said this unipolar moment will last maybe 30 or 40 years. Hmm. And then we begin the defense planning guidance and these ideas that are going to lead in 1997 to the Project for a New American Century.
Yes.
And they were concerned that without an enemy, we were not spending enough on our military. And those are the people who all went in with George W. Bush into all the top positions in the George W. Bush administration. And then in 2002, after the U.S. invades Afghanistan, Krauthammer says, no, I was wrong in 1990. This is not America's unipolar moment. This is the unipolar era, and it's going to last indefinitely, maybe even hundreds of years, that nobody anywhere can challenge the United States. And then we invade Iraq.
Yeah.
But even before that, you look at the Sunday New York Times magazine section, January 5th, 2003, big headlines, American Empire, get used to it. And at that point, all the leading neocons started to come out of the woodwork and say, yes, we are an empire. We're the biggest empire the world has ever seen, and we're proud of it. And then you had the people at the Pentagon saying, we have a hit list of seven countries. There's going to be Syria and, you know, Iraq, Iran, and Libya. I mean, they went through them, and we were going to flip all these countries, and the U.S. was going to put its imprint on everything that was happening in the world.
And the funny thing is, everything that you just described, you can literally read if you go to the documents written by the Project for the New American Century, of which the Bushes, the Cheneys, Rumsfeld, Krauthammer, and a lot of these people were a part of. And it's funny because none of that was ever public. This is not something that was discussed publicly. This is not something that was discussed in Congress or in the U.S. Senate or in some committee hearing. These were all secret meetings of people essentially planning to take over the world.
We've had that over and over again. And sometimes they're very public. You know, they don't really hide this stuff. They say what their plans are, and people go along with it. If you go back to the Trilateral Commission, which was more benign, or the Committee on the Present Danger during the Reagan period, I mean, you've got these various groupings, mostly what Ben Rhodes calls the blob. It's the foreign policy establishment, people whose vision and goal is to establish American dominance throughout the world.
And you find them, by the way, I just had to say this, I know I've interrupted you twice now, I apologize. I see these people you're talking about on Fox and on NBC and on CNN and on MSNBC and on ABC. They're the experts. These are the people they call in to say, what do we need to do next in this world to make sure we can handle situation X or B? These guys have lost everything they've attempted to do. I mean, they're the guys who choreographed the Iraq War, and they're called like, oh, Queen Sheba, please tell me, oh, wise one, what I'm supposed to do. That's crazy that this still happens. I see it every night.
Yeah. I mean, it is shocking. These people who got a horrible track record.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that they're so incompetent, because most of their plans and vision are worse than what we're getting. However, now they are on a rampage. And that's what's so dangerous right now. at these same people who've been planning U.S. foreign policy for decades throughout the Cold War and then the post-Cold War now see this as their opportunity to destroy Russia once and for all.
Yeah, after destroy, I mean, they screwed up Vietnam. They screwed up Vietnam. They screwed up Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Iraq. I mean, the only thing they got right, I think, was Grenada, an island with sheep. And now they're kind of doing the same thing in Ukraine, it seems to me.
Well, Operation Urgent Fury in Grenada was not nearly as successful as they wanted to make it out to be. And it's come on the heels of the bombing in Lebanon, which, what was it, 243 Marines were killed.
Right.
And Reagan is looking for a distraction. And they use this excuse about the American medical students who were threatened in Grenada.
Yeah.
And then they go in there and they don't even try to rescue the students for three more days. And the students did a poll and they said they didn't feel threatened. They didn't want the U.S. to intervene. And they go in there and we confront a couple dozen Cuban construction workers who are building an airport runway.
Yeah.
And we a lot of American troops. It was even that was a debacle, but we didn't let them. We learned the lesson of Vietnam, and they didn't let the media in. The U.S. fed the media who were in Doha and other places outside of Grenada.
Yeah.
And one of the lessons was that we're back to what you're saying before. They have to control the media.
By the way, as we conclude this, because we're out of time, I must say, I was one of those members of the media. I was a correspondent at the time for NBC. And I flew down there, and I spent most of my time in Guadeloupe. They did not let us get into Grenada. We had to cover it from afar, from another country, another island. And all we could see was some of the howitzers being brought in from time to time and fired from there. So amazing story. Professor, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Rick, anytime.
Peter Kuznick, and that's our show. Remember, always look outside your own box when you're looking for truths, because truths, as we like to say, they don't live in boxes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll see you next time.